Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
Of all the everyday miracles of being human, our ability to remember is one of the most mysterious. By what rules does the brain determine which experience can be safely forgotten and which ones will always be accessible to us? Why does recalling one thing inevitably lead our minds to another, and where do those memories live within the brain? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Neuroscientists have made some very exciting leaps toward answering those questions in recent years, thanks to diligent and creative studies, innovative technology, and at least a little bit of serendipity. Alcino J. Silva is distinguished professor and director of the Integrative Center for Learning and Memory at UCLA, where his team is on the leading edge of this research. He explained some big developments in his July cover story for Scientific American magazine, The Web of Memories. Alcino, welcome to Think.
Hey, good morning.
You make the point here that science is as much about finding the right questions as it is about answering them. It's a complicated thing to figure out what questions to ask to figure out how memory works.
Absolutely. Often we are led by instinct and interest. And as you said, you know, serendipity really plays a big role. You know, serendipity really is about taking that opportunity when one sees it. And it's a combination of a lot of factors. And I just feel so fortunate that in my career, you know, serendipity has really been helpful.
Well, you have to work hard to know that you have discovered something serendipitous, right? You have to have a lot of knowledge to begin with.
Well, you know, the serendipity part of it is the beginning. It's that seed. Eventually, what you report, what you share with the world is the tree. But without that seed, the tree will not have come. And that's what I mean by that. I have been fortunate to have worked with a group of really, really talented young scientists. And I'm here today talking with you, mostly because of them, to be frank. But a lab is a unit. It's at the same time a family and a team. And we spend a lot of time together. We think together. And when we find a topic that galvanizes our interest, magic can happen.
So you were having this conversation with a friend and colleague named Michael Davis. How did that discussion help you form questions about how the brain decides where to house memories and by what process?
Yeah, this was actually an interesting thing because Mike was actually complaining to me because one of his scientific papers was published. He submitted and then was accepted, but never published because the editor, you know, rejected after having accepted it, which is highly unusual. And he was complaining to me as a friend. We were friends for a couple of years. We had discussed collaborating and had seen each other many times at meetings. And I was visiting Yale to come and give a talk about our recent work. And Mike was just complaining about this. I can't believe my scientific paper was accepted and then, you know, rejected. And I was very curious about why, because that's so unusual. And he said, the editor just thought that the experiment we did didn't make any sense. Essentially, what Mike did was to place the DNA for a gene called CREB in a few cells in a structure that's critical for emotional memory. And then he showed that it could enhance emotional memory in rats. This experiment was carried out in rats. So what was wrong with this? What seemed puzzling to the editor and what drove to the rejection of that paper was the fact that only a small percentage of cells in this memory structure was affected by the gene. And the question was, wait a second, if only a small number of cells was affected by the gene, how did the emotional memories that were enhanced knew to go to those cells? At the time, we had no mechanism, we had no way. So, the discovery was suspecting, and that led to its eventual rejection. Now, I wasn't emotionally engaged in any of this because I was visiting. This was not my work. I had worked on CREB itself, the gene that's so critical for memory, but I was not involved in that study. And I think that distance allowed me to take a step back and ask, wow, you know, the journal is unfair by having accepted and rejected, but I think the journal is a good question. How did the memory note go to those cells? Now, I believe the results because I knew Mike and his group, and I knew that they were a first-rate group, so whatever they discovered was probably right. And that question didn't leave my mind for months. And that's where the whole project comes from. Unfortunately, built on someone else's misfortune. But that's what serendipity is all about, you know? You find it in the most unlikely places.
So if I understand this right, neurons that have higher levels of Kreb, this gene, are more excitable than the cells nearby and therefore more receptive to memories?
And that's what we have discovered after years of looking into this. But fundamentally, what attracted me to this question was that we simply didn't know what are the rules in the brain that dedicate certain memories to specific neurons in a brain region. So, for example, we knew already that emotional memories engage the amygdala. It's this structure that we have been talking about, so critical for emotional memories. But what we didn't know is what neurons in the amygdala are engaged by which memory and what are the rules that regulate this? And you may say, well, this is an esoteric question. Who really cares other than a small group of scientists around the world? Well, it turns out that this question of what to place, what memory where, consumed, you know, computer scientists. And computers and how well they work depend on the rules that determine which information goes where at each step in time. That really facilitates how computers work, optimizes how they work. So we reason that because we have so many memories throughout our lifetime, millions of memories, organizing them is critical so we can get, you know, to them easily. One process of organizing them is where are they stored in the first place? That has to be very complex or maybe simple. but, you know, there has to be mechanisms that organize these memories. We can't just place them anywhere because it's so critical. Sometimes it makes the difference between life and death that we get them fast when we need them. So we thought, wow, it's amazing that no one knows anything about this. And we got busy trying to figure this out.
So what is special, Elsino, about memories of frightening or traumatic things? Why is it easier to remember being chased by a dog that is barking and snarling than sitting down with your cousin and playing checkers when you were the same age?
You know, evolution has shaped our brain to answer the challenges that we face. And any time that we are chased by a snarling dog, we better remember it so we can avoid it. Because a single bite not long ago, you know, without antibiotics, may mean death. The leg getting infected, the leg being cut off, and then the rest of the body going along with it. So, you know, knowing what's dangerous, knowing what triggers our emotions, fear, for example, is the case that we are talking about, is absolutely critical, and we should remember it because, again, our lives may depend upon it. But again, the opposite is also true. If we have a really good memory, you know, I found this patch of land where the berries are abundant and sweet. You know, a long time ago when we didn't have our agriculture and we depended on foraging, knowing where those patches of food happened to be literally may have saved our lives. So the joy of finding them justified our brain's focus on it and our ability to store that information. So emotion, essentially, is an amplifier of memory. If we want to remember something, add some emotion to it. If you want others to remember something, add some emotion to it. That's a general rule.
So anybody who has sat alone with his or her thoughts for any time realizes that one thought leads quite naturally to another. Your sense was that some memories get encoded together in the same neurons, or at least they share some of the same neurons. Talk about how that became clear.
Yeah, actually, that came right because of the work that we just briefly alluded to just a minute ago. So we start studying how do memories choose where they go. And we actually discovered that the gene Kreb is involved and the gene CREB is important because it regulates the synthesis of other proteins, and the class of these proteins increases the excitability of these neurons. So now we have an answer for why certain neurons are picked. But then the next obvious answer that we asked all along is, why is it important to regulate where memories go? And what we realized, that, but hadn't suspected in the very beginning, is that one of the key reasons, not the only one, but one of the key reasons why it's important to regulate where memories go is because memories don't exist by themselves. Most of our memories exist in strings, within strings of other memories, so that we can relate one thing to another. And that's really important. Not just one thing to another as they happen simultaneously in time. Like, for example, if you place your hand on a hot stove when you're a little boy, you learn, wow, hot stoves are not to be touched because it really hurts. So those two events happen at the same time, placing the hand on the hot stove and being burned. But we also link information which doesn't occur at the same time, information that may occur hours apart. We go to a party, we are slightly impolite to that gentleman, and later on we find out that that gentleman is in our promotions committee. And then we go, wow, that's why I wasn't promoted. Maybe next time when I go to parties, I shouldn't be as obnoxious as I normally am. As, for example, I learned early on in my career. So, you know, linking memories in time allows us to use information that happens at one time to predict what may come at a later time. You know, I embarked near this high grass and, you know, I just realized that there's a lot of snakes in this high grass. And so I should really avoid it. And if I have to cross it, then I really have to be on the lookout. Entering that part of the savanna may have taken place 2 hours before I actually was bitten and nearly died. But next time I cross it, I better connect and relate, you know, the two memories. So that's, you know, that's really critical. It's an absolutely critical part of memory, and one that we were so fortunate to have stumbled upon and found a mechanism for.
So your work has been advanced by new technologies that allow you to switch off neurons where you believe memories are stored, in rodents. How do you do that?
You know, I'll tell you, every time I talk about this, every time I think about it, it just hasn't worn off. I am just filled with wonder because it wasn't long ago that the idea that we could activate or inhibit specific neurons in the brain was a far-fetched sci-fi dream, you know? And now we can actually do that. It turns out that a number of scientists have discovered these proteins that we can place in neurons, and these proteins make neurons more happy to fire and more reluctant to fire by manipulating the very processes that affect when and how much a neuron will be active. And the amazing thing is that we can manipulate this with light. So we can place this protein, it's part of a general field in science called optogenetics. They're called opsins. We can place them in neurons of our choice. And then later on, by simply shining on that area of the brain the right light, which activates these proteins, we can either excite that neuron, meaning make them be active, fire, or we can inhibit that neuron.
Wow.
And that way, we and others have been able to trigger certain memories or inactivate certain memories in rodents.
And it's just
humans.
Temporary, right? You can bring those memories back. All right, we'll talk more in just a minute with my guest, Alcino J. Silva, director of the Integrative Center for Learning and Memory at UCLA. He wrote the July cover story in Scientific American magazine. It's called The Web of Memories. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Alcino J. Silva, director of the Integrative Center for Learning and Memory at UCLA and author of the July cover story in Scientific American magazine. It was called The Web of Memories. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Alcino, what kind of experience is upsetting enough for a lab mouse that it can be used to create this sort of emotional memory for the kind of study that you were doing?
So we use a variety of techniques to test memory in mice. Some just involve exposing the mice to other mice. They remember other mice, just like we remember other people. Some involve asking them to find a place on a maze, as so many people know. We don't use cheese, by the way. So we don't use the little piece of cheese in somewhere in a maze. But, you know, mice swim like we do, and we place them in a pool of water about a meter and a half wide. And there's a little platform that they can hop on to get out of the water. It's a little swimming pool, and they learn to find, you know, the platform, although they can't see it. So that's another test. Another one is that we place mice in a chamber, and we give them a very mild electric shock. Actually, I always ask my students to put their hands on it to see how mild it is, but it's enough that the animals are wary of it because it's a different sensation. Mm-hmm. If you ever placed your hand on a socket or something and got, you know, that tingling sensation. So we place the mice in these chambers, and so next time when we place them back on the same chamber, mice remember this and they don't move as much. Why don't they move as much? Because they are slightly afraid, because this was a novel stimulus, you know, for them, and they're slightly afraid, and they stop moving when they're afraid, because in the wild, by not moving, predators will miss them. They won't see them, because predators see movement far better than they see individual things. So we use a variety of tests, actually, in order to be able to see whether mice learn and remember. Sometimes we expose them just to a novel chamber. And when we bring them back, we have a variety of ways of knowing that they remember that chamber, the way they act within the chamber. So there's a variety of ways. And having a variety of ways, it's actually important, because when you find the same answer with more than one way, then you are more sure of it than when you just find it with one way only, as it's obvious. So, yeah, so we have ways of looking at memory in mice. And what we have found so far is that their memories are a lot like ours.
So what's the relationship between the way the brain allocates memories, decides where they will go and be stored in the brain, and the way it links discrete memories to one another?
Yeah, that's a question that has, you know, consumed us of our lab, actually, over the last, almost 10 years, 10, 15 years, actually. The idea is that when the first memory goes to group of cells A, for example, let's imagine, if you look at your hand, let's imagine that each one of your fingers is a cell. So you'll be looking at five different cells, okay? Mm-hmm. So, and let's say that memory goes to those five cells, your five fingers. Then when another memory, you know, comes along within a certain span of time, and that's critical. If you wait, you know, long enough, then the memory goes to an entire different group of cells. But let's say that the memory comes in, let's say 5, 6, 7 hours later, okay? Then those five cells, well, it's not five, obviously, it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of cells in the brain. But let's look at just at our hand, those five cells. So most of those will be taken by the second memory. So there's an overlap, you know, between the neurons that store the first memory and the second. Why does this happen? Because the first memory makes those neurons that store the first memory more readily available to store the second memory. Okay, what does that mean? They're more excitable. They're more ready to respond to the incoming stimuli that carry that information that needs to be stored in the brain. So now the other memory goes to a lot of the same five neurons, let's say. So later on, when you remember the first memory, those neurons become active, right? And because there are a lot of the same neurons that encoded the second memory, then you're more likely to recall that second memory that happened 6 hours later than any other memory that may have happened, you know, 7 days later or a month before. And that's how we link memories across time. Of course, I should say, I have to be careful. Memories are not, they are stored in cells, of course, in the brain. They're stored in neurons. But we now know that synapses, the point of contact between two neurons, are really a critical cell place for the storage of memory. And each cell has many, many synapses. So that means that each cell can actually store many memories. But it's the combination of cells that gives a unique signature to each memory. So that's why we can associate memory A with B and not associate it with C, D, and E, and F that happened some other time. So there's this code in the brain that we can take advantage of to give each memory a unique signature that then identifies it in time and allows us then to connect with other memories that come later or that came before, but within 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, but not 7, 8, 10 days.
Okay, so the closeness in time makes sense because, you know, things are more likely to be relevant to one another if they happened within the same few hours. But I'm curious, you know, if you think of an old library card catalog, are our memories cross-referenced? So maybe something really upsetting happened on this afternoon, and I remember something else that happened an hour before, but maybe when that happened, I was, you know, carrying a yellow umbrella. If I see somebody else with a yellow umbrella, is that likely to trigger the memory, and are they cross-referenced in that way as well?
You know, you are so right. You're absolutely right. So one way that we link memories across time is by taking advantage of time. That's a more challenging question because the two memories may have nothing in common,
mm-hmm.
right? So one may be, as we said before, about you talking with someone in a party, and the next thing, it's about you finding out later on in that party that that person is in your review committee, right? So, I mean, these two memories are very different in terms of content. But one thing that we have known is that when memories share content, like, for example, you talked about the yellow umbrella, they allow that content to serve as a bridge between the two memories, you know? And again, that's highly significant, you know, for us because we may have... You know, sometimes we learn that things, I gave that example when we were, as a child, if you touch the hot stove, well, that hot stove was of one kind, but you don't need to be afraid of just that type of stove. You are afraid of any other object that looks a lot like the one that, you know, triggered that pain. So we generalize. We also use objects to link memories so that I'm, you know, this process of linking memories is really important. One aspect of this linking process is time, and you mentioned another one, which is content.
Are memories that are linked together, do they reinforce one another?
Again, another wonderful question, actually. And the answer is yes, because, it's one of the things that we discover, and Sheena Jocelyn in Toronto also discovered, which is, it turns out, and this is the magic of nature, so it turns out that the process of storing information activates this protein called CREB. And CREB does two key but related things. We talked about one already. CREB directs an increase in the excitability of those cells so they can be engaged in another memory in the next 5, 6, 7 hours or so. So that's one thing that CREB does. But CREB does another thing, which is to consolidate that first memory or to make sure that it is stored. Okay, the word consolidate just means that there are processes following memory formation that need to take place for that memory to be stored for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is that in the process of consolidating that memory, Krebs activity goes up. And it turns out that those cells with more excitability also have Krebs that's more active. So when another memory comes around, then that second memory can take advantage of the additional levels of CREB and then become stronger than otherwise would have been. So you're absolutely right. In addition to linking memories. The process, this process that involves Crabbe, also strengthens these linked memories, again, reinforcing how important this process is for the brain.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our telephone number, 1-800-933-5372. Dan is on the line in Denton. Hi, Dan. Hi, Dan, are you with us? Okay, let's move on and speak with Kate in Garland. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi, Kate.
I have two short questions. I'm 70. I have spectacular memory, and I met a 76-year-old cousin last year who could tell me what was happening 50 years ago and how our families interlinked and all that. So is this kind of memory genetic? Is one question.
So that is one. It turns out that just about everything that's biological, that's human, has a genetic component that can be affected by genes either way, by making that something, including memory, better or by making it worse. It works both ways. But memory is more than just genes. Memory has a lot, you know, to do with what happens to us during development in the womb, you know, what happens after development. Our diets, our exercise, sleep, there are many factors that affect memory. But you are absolutely right. One of those factors is genes.
So Kate mentioned that she is 70. That's an age at which a lot of us notice it's not quite as easy to permanently store new memories of things that have happened recently. Could we somehow flood our brains with Crabbe and suddenly be better at remembering?
Actually, you know, funny that idea may seem, and I said, I think you said that somewhat facetiously, mm-hmm. but there are companies that are trying to do just that, not flood our brains with Crabbe, but actually understand what activates Crabbe and then design drugs that we could use to increase the levels of Crabbe activity when we need it, as we grow old, for example, or in individuals that have problems with learning and memory in general. So the way I see it in terms of drugs and memory, I see it as a way to help people that have memory problems. Now, there's a very interesting and complementary question, which is, can we take someone that's normal, that has a normal memory, and design drugs that may enhance that person's memory? That's a far more complex question because, you see, useful memory is not just about storing information. Useful memory is more about forgetting information. We go through the world and we are bombarded with information, more now than ever, most of which we actually want to actively forget it. So if you come in with a drug that increases memory, is it going to help you or hurt you? That's not clear. If you have poor memory, it will definitely help you. If you are a patient that's on the verge of Alzheimer's and dementia, can't remember to turn off the stove when you know people walk out of their house, they are confused and can't remember how to get back. Clearly, memory drugs are black and white, helpful, and we are working really hard to develop those. But for people with normal memories, that's a more tricky question because memory is as much about remembering as it is about forgetting.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Alcino J. Silva, director of the Integrative Center for Learning and Memory at UCLA, about his article, which appeared in Scientific American magazine as the cover story last month. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk for a minute about how you and your team discovered a way to effectively see in real time memories being created in a mouse brain. This is like a synthesis of technology and creativity in terms of how the experiment was designed. Can you talk a little bit about the specialized mouse hat microscope?
You know, I have been so fortunate as a scientist to work at a time where there are all these technologies coming out essentially as a consequence of our country's investment on science. And these technologies are making a huge difference because they are transforming the speed at which we can understand those things that matter in our lives, one of them being memory. So one of these technologies has been the miniaturization of the microscope. Mark Schnitzer at Stanford University, Mark and his group at Stanford University, developed these miniaturized microscopes. They are so they're so small that you can place them on top of a head of a mouse, and a mouse is quite small. They weigh about 2 grams, and get access to neurons in the head, in the brain of a mouse as it's learning and remembering. So this was one key step. The other key step that enabled these studies was the discovery of these molecules that fluoresce when a neuron is active, which are just as magical. So there are these molecules, and they bind calcium. Calcium concentrations change inside of neurons when they're active, and they allow us to see which neurons are active in time. So if a mouse is learning something, and we have one of those little microscopes on their head, these little microscopes can detect which cells in a particular structure are being active as the animal is learning. That information is sent to a computer, and then we can simply look at the computer, that field of view, and we can say that cell was just active when the animal was learning about the cage. Later on, we can bring that back the animal to the cage, and there it is. The cell can be active. We see the cell active again. And then we can inhibit that cell and show that the animal partially loses its memory. Of course, this is not done at a one-cell basis. This is done at many cells, because we can view many cells and we can inhibit many cells. But that's the principle. The principle is that we can not only see memories being formed, as you said, because of these little microscopes and because of these molecules that fluoresce when these neurons are active, but we can then manipulate their function and be sure that they were really involved in memory.
Wow. My guest is Alcino J. Silva, director of UCLA's Integrative Center for Learning and Memory. His article, The Web of Memories, was the July cover story in Scientific American Magazine. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the director of the Integrative Center for Learning and Memory at UCLA, Alcino J. Silva. He wrote the cover story for Scientific American Magazine last month. It was called The Web of Memories. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org. Alcino, you mentioned earlier that a healthy brain is good at forgetting just the way it's good at remembering. It's important that we don't remember every single thing. So here's my question, and I don't know if the answer to this is known yet. When I have forgotten something, and I don't even remember that I've forgotten it, it's not like information that I know that I knew at one point, has that memory just evaporated, or is it more like a decommissioned train car that is taken off the track so it's not connected to any synapses that would bring it to mind, but it still exists there, and if somehow it could be reconnected, I could access it again?
It turns out that, surprisingly, we know very little about forgetting, actually. And how memories are recovered after having been, quote-unquote, forgotten. But one thing we do know, which is that memories can be strengthened and weakened, and once a memory is weakened to the point of having very poor recall, there are certain procedures that can bring that memory back. One of those that has been extensively studied is the reminder effect. you know. So even a small fragment of that memory that we may encounter may give us access to a memory that that otherwise may have been inaccessible to us or, quote unquote, you know, forgotten. How many memories are truly forgotten? It's hard to answer because we don't understand the mechanism. If we understood the mechanism, we may be able to get to it. Of course, in dementia, when there is extensive neural death, we can guess that one of the reasons why memory is inaccessible is because the very neurons that stored it are gone now. But for a healthy brain, why are some memories more accessible than others? That's a very simple question and one that we have not understood yet at a mechanistic level. And I think it would be really interesting. It has only been recently that we have realized, by recently I mean the last 20, 30 years, that we have realized in the scientific community at large, subsets of the community have known this for quite some time and tried to get all of us interested in it. But in general, it has only been the last 20, 30 years that we have recognized as a community that memory is as much about forgetting as it is about, you know, remembering. Not long ago, a very prominent neuroscientist wrote a book about the sins of memory. And what's interesting about that book is that every single one of the so-called seven sins of memory is really reflects not a problem with memory, but actually one of memory's properties, this need to filter carefully through all that we are exposed to and only bring to mind those things that can be the most useful.
All right, let's go. Let's read an email here. This one's from James, and he wants to know if your research can help him study and learn better. Is there anything that you've discovered in your memory allocation research that might help people who want to remember?
It turns out that it may very well be that by organizing information in appropriate ways, we may be more likely to link that information. Like for example, before we even came along with our mechanistic studies where we're actually looking at molecules and neurons and circuits and parts of the brain, people that studied memory, they knew that if we want to understand how two subjects are interconnected, let's say that you are learning math and physics, and everybody knows that in order to do serious physics, you have to know a lot of math, right? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that by learning them together, side by side, and studying them together side by side, not spend a semester doing a lot of math and a semester doing a lot of physics, that kind of thing, but actually learning them side by side, that we are more likely to integrate them, to see how one applies to the other, to build those bridges that would allow us to most efficiently use one in the other. And I think what our studies have done is to provide a mechanistic explanation for that. So what I would say to James is that if you want to remember things together, things that you should remember together, then you should study them and learn them together, instead of separately. And a lot of education these days is really about integrating information from one discipline into the other. And we know that by learning them side by side, by integrating their study, that we are going to be able to teach students how to integrate that information more efficiently.
All right, let's speak now with Carmen in San Antonio. Hi, Carmen.
Hi, this is Carmen.
Hi.
I have two questions. One is the use of color in memory and music. I work in the medical field, and I find like patients going into hospitals, they don't know where to go, they get lost, and I always say they should have like a yellow brick road, like a little road to get you somewhere, or a lot of the use of these electronic systems where I don't think that they're using enough to connect the memory with colors. So I just want to have your answers, if you can get me answers for those areas. Thank you.
Sure. I'm delighted that you noticed that. Any time that we use something, in your case, in your wonderful example, color, to connect things, like, for example, where are you to go? You go along this hallway, and then you need to remember to go right and left. And having color as a means, something simple, as a means to bridge information, it's really important and really useful. Again, how does this happen in the brain? And that's the topic that we are so interested in understanding, how we use information, you know, certain aspects of information like color, for example, as the link, the bridge, you know, between between different memories. Other labs have been interested in this. Allison Preston's lab in Austin, Texas, for example, they study memory in humans, and they have known that when memories have something in common, in your, you know, very good example, color, you know, the yellow color, yellow brick road, right? Then they are more easily integrated. So I think that's a really good example, and it really taps into the mechanisms that we have been talking about.
How many memories can any neuron or group of neurons hold? And is it even possible to quantify the approximate number of memories a human brain might possess?
People have tried that, and for that calculation, they have had to make some bold assumptions, mm-hmm. okay? Now, to me, those assumptions are useful as you build models of the brain, and building models of the brain are incredibly important because if we are to understand this organ, which may be one of our most important organs, then you need to model it. You need to try to figure out how it works, not just one piece at a time, but how it all works together. So I admire my colleagues that do this work, but my sense, not being on that area, because my lab is an experimental lab, my sense is that these assumptions are very thinly based. So how many memories do we hold on a lifetime? I don't think anyone really knows. How many memories are held in a single neuron? We know that many neurons in the brain, like for example, the neurons that we studied in this structure of the brain called hippocampus, in our recent papers that you know, there was that Scientific American story about, those neurons have about 10,000 synapses. So if you think of memory as combinations of different neurons all working together to store a given memory, and then if you ask how many synapses are engaged by a single memory in a single neuron, and that's on the order of a few, nobody knows for sure, but it's not 1,000. It's not one. It's more than one, less than 1,000, probably a few. And there are many ways that people have tried to calculate that. So then you can see how many memories could be held in a single neuron. I guess the more appropriate question is, how many memories does a single neuron participate in? Mm-hmm. Because no memory is held on a single neuron. A neuron is part of a network of neurons that stores a given memory, and that network may be in multiple brain regions, right? So, but the question is, for a single neuron, how many memories can that neuron be a part of throughout a lifetime? Probably a lot, because some memories come and go, and then that neuron will be able to be engaged in memories when you are 30 that are different than when you were 18. That kind of thing. So that's a very hard question to ask, but it's an important one. It's an interesting one.
My guest is Alcino J. Silva, who directs the Integrative Center for Learning and Memory at UCLA. He wrote the cover story for the July issue of Scientific American magazine called The Web of Memories. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When that little network of neurons that contains a memory fires off because a memory has been triggered, what does it take for that event to find its way into our consciousness, if that makes any sense?
No, it makes absolute sense. At what level does the activation of a group of neurons rises to the level of full recall?
Right.
Again, this is a question that we would love to be able to answer. We have part of the answer, and we have gotten there. And by we, I'm talking about not just my lab, of course, but the collection of neuroscientists around the world, many in our country, that are studying this question. We have been able to go in and inhibit subpopulations of neurons and then ask, what does that do to recall? So we know that there has to be a large number, and the other way around too, that we have been able to go in and activate, you know, certain groups of neurons. So we know that it's more than a few neurons. It's on the order of thousands that can activate full recall. How do we know this? Because we can create a memory, mark those neurons with molecules that allow us to activate them later on. And then later on, at a time of our choosing, we go on with light, as we spoke just a few minutes ago, and then see if the animal remembers. Wow. In memory tests that we've designed for animals. So we know that activating on the order of tens of thousands of neurons in a particular brain structure is enough to activate the full-blown recall of that memory. And sometimes the opposite, sometimes inhibiting tens of thousands of neurons in one structure alone is enough for us to repress that memory. So yes, we are starting to get some answers to that question, because now we have been able to actually nail down in the brain some of the neurons that are needed for recall with these new wonder technologies that allow us to not only see them when they're active, but allow us to inhibit or activate them.
I'm glad you brought up those technologies, because you make a point of saying that the groundbreaking work that your lab has done was possible in part because other scientists, other labs shared techniques and technologies with you. You're a big proponent of open source science. I know this is challenging for some scientists in a world where seemingly everybody is competing with one another for funding, for attention. How do you make it work practically, even when for the pure science, you want to be able to share everything?
Sure. I mean, the way I think about it, I think of the tools like a brush of a painter, right? So the brush does not define the painter. What defines the painter is the magic of the canvas. And science is the same way. You know, technologies just enable labs to do experiments that they couldn't possibly do. But the magic is not in the technology. The magic is in what you make of what the technology tells you. You know, science is very creative. You know, one scientist sees one thing, another scientist sees something entirely different. In one scientist's eyes, something is magical and beautiful and inspiring. In the other, it's just an observation that's dull and not terribly interesting. The same observation. So there's this creative process. And the way I see it is that, you know, technology should be open sourced in science. It's about giving brushes to people. Let the canvas tell the story, not whether you can get access to the brushes. And actually, one of the things that we did when we used our own miniscopes, we came up with our own designs of these miniscopes, which were an improvement over the ones that were there before. And we immediately put them online, and people could download where we bought each of the little things from, because there's all these electronic companies that make these tiny little things that we used in making these little microscopes. So immediately we're able to share with the world, and now there are hundreds of labs worldwide that used our design simply because we placed it on the web and helped people. We also held these seminars in many places around the world where we taught people how to use them, how to do the analysis of the data, all that you need to use that particular brush. It's fun, you know, it's so fun to share with people because they're excited about it, and then they report their findings and you generate momentum. Anyway, it has been great fun.
Alcino J. Silva is Distinguished Professor and Director of the Integrative Center for Learning and Memory at UCLA. His article, The Web of Memories, was the cover story in Scientific American magazine last month. Alcino, thank you so much for sharing what you've learned and also your enthusiasm for this. I really appreciate
your time.
Oh,
this has been fun, Chris. You know, being a scientist is a privilege of the highest order. And, you know, every day I go to work and I thank the Lord for the ability of doing what I do.
Well, thank you again. Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter handle is @KERAThink. You can find the podcast at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.